Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of Not in a Creepy Way, the podcast where the brothers Anderson will dig deep into the movies. The brothers Anderson are. This is Eric, he's the oldest one. The producer who makes it fun, gotta give him the credit. He's good with the edits. He's been the driving force since they begun. Next we got brother Jay. He just the movies that they play. The sip in the middle, Jay is gonna be a little more critical, analytical when he communicates. And lastly we got Drew, the finally family member of this group. He decides if the movie's worth it. Right kind of guy, that's for certain. Three chatty brothers with a family base. Need an excuse to talk away. Dichotomy of personalities. All you really need to do is press play. One podcast talk show. Hit the app if you want to catch an episode. They talk movies till they go off on a tangent flow and maybe ramble. That's the brothers Anderson. So sit back with closed eyes. Let them take you away unless you're driving. Keep them open in that case. We got Eric, Drew, and brother Jay. Welcome you to Not in a Creepy Way. Hey.
Not in a creepy way. Hey. Not in a creepy way. Not in a creepy way. Hey. Not in a creepy way. Okay. Not in a creepy way. Hey. Not in a creepy way. We got Eric, Drew, and brother Jay. Welcome you to Not in a Creepy Way.
Hey. Welcome. This is Eric.
This is brother Jay.
This is Drew.
And tonight we're going to talk about the 2007 film Michael Clayton, written and directed by Tony Gilroy.
A film so dark it destroyed brother Jay's laptop.
It did. Yes, we are recording a day late because we tried this last night. And there was a catastrophic failure on Brother Jay's end.
Yeah. I don't know what happened there.
Can I just shoehorn this in? Big thanks to Brother Drew. Also, big thanks to Jewel Big Green for our new theme song.
Yeah.
I'm glad it turned out okay.
Oh, it turned out great.
Yeah, I really like Songfinch. That's my third purchase of a song from scratch from Songfinch, and I've been happy with the results of all three.
Okay, one was a birthday song for your wife.
Mm-hmm.
And one was this theme song. And what was your other song?
A camping song.
A hip hop camping song?
No, it was a what was it?
Country music camping song?
Acoustic pop.
Oh, excellent. Are you willing to share this acoustic pop camping song? Or is it just a personal family song?
No, I can share it.
Okay, well maybe at the end of this episode we'll play your camping song. Who's the artist on the camping song?
Her name is Anna, or maybe Anna Schulze. She has some music available through iTunes.
Yeah, Jewel Big Green apparently is something of a DJ professionally. So he has music recorded that you can buy, and you can hire him for events.
He's super awesome.
Yeah, I think he did a really good job. I don't know if you got my message, but I sent him a thank you note, and he said, yeah, actually, he has a version that has all those movie quotes that we've been using in our opening, but for legal reasons, he's not allowed to use them. So yeah, well, that's...
He did it really fast because I purchased a song on Tuesday. And so the first thing you do is you purchase a song, and then whenever you want after that, I did it right away. You go in and you sort of fill out the information about what type of music, what it's about, who it's for. And then you give some details. And then they commit to turning around a song to you within 7 days. And, so the last time I did it, I bought the song on Friday because I wanted it by the next Friday, and it was actually ready on Monday. And this time I bought it on Tuesday and it was ready Thursday afternoon. So I didn't even notice that I got the email that it was ready because I wasn't looking for it. So he turned it around super quickly.
And it's a long song. I mean, we can break it up into lots of little things. Like there's an opening, there's a closing. We can use it for bumper stuff.
Yeah. And I think there's like a little lull in the middle because what I gathered from the correspondence I had with the dude, I think the head of Songfinch, was when they do songs for podcasts for real. Well, for one thing, it costs way more money than they charge me, because we are sort of a not sort of we are a not for profit entity at the moment.
Oh yeah, most definitely.
So the licensing is much easier. We're not allowed to use the song for anything that makes money.
No problem there.
Yeah, but if it was like a for profit venture, they have more robust licenses, and those songs cost, they start at $500 and go up from there. But they also, he gave me the option of just doing, since it was for like a podcast intro, of just doing a like verse and chorus, so that you wouldn't have to edit it down and it wouldn't be too long. But I know how much you love editing, so
I was going to say, we know the master of editing.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I want the whole thing.
Give me the whole song.
So, okay, I want to chop it up and yeah.
Yeah. So I suspect that's why there's that kind of little lull in the middle to give you a nice break if you wanted an easy edit there.
Yeah,
I see a remix in your future.
Now, I'll let the actual remixes to the professionals, but I can definitely take pieces and make things out of them. You know, again, like bumpers and like the end will be different than the beginning. And because, yeah, there's that natural break. So, yeah, he did a great job.
Yeah, I'm glad you guys liked it. I was hopeful, but since I didn't get any input from you and never was uncertain how it would turn out and how you'd react.
Oh,
no, great. I was amazingly impressed. So well done.
I woke my wife up to play it for her.
How was that received?
Well, it was received better in the morning when she was awake when she heard it.
Jesse made me play it 3 or 4 times for him. So,
Journey wants to do a cousin's podcast. I said, well, okay. It's going to take some work, but.
Yeah, that'll be challenging to pull off, but.
Yeah.
Ambitious.
She did say, though, at the end, she would give a little plug to our podcast.
Well, that's nice.
Exactly. I said, well, gee, I guess I better mention you and our podcast. She's like, yeah. Are we ready for Michael Clayton?
Yeah. I've been ready.
Okay. This is the directorial debut of Tony Gilroy. He is actually known more as a writer. He did the screenplays or adaptations for all of the Bourne movies, Proof of Life, Armageddon, The Devil's Advocate, Extreme Measures, Dolores Claiborne, and The Cutting Edge. And he directed Duplicity and The Bourne Legacy and this. And I think a couple other things too.
Woohoo, and this is where my laptop died last night. So.
Yeah. Yeah. And Disney brought him in to do extensive rewrites and reshoots for Rogue One.
Ah, yes. So he's something of a fixer.
A janitor, as he calls
janitor,
himself.
Janitor, yes.
Mm-hmm.
And through Kismet, this is also our second Tom Wilkinson movie in a row.
He's so good.
He's great.
Is there anything he's not good in?
No. Nope.
I can't think of anything.
He's in the Grand Budapest Hotel.
It's coming up.
Did either of you see a movie called In the Bedroom?
No.
No.
He was in The Ghost Rider, if you recall.
I don't recall, but it seems right.
He was Paul Emmett. He was her handler.
Oh, okay.
Spoiler. He was the professor that the writer goes to see on the island.
Oh, yes. Okay.
Yeah. In the Bedroom's a really, really good movie. Really good performances by Tom Wilkinson and Sissy Spacek. It's really hard to watch, though.
He also played Benjamin Franklin. I can totally see that.
Yeah, I can see that, too. So, Brother Jay, this is your movie, your pick.
Yes.
Okay. So, tell me about your history with Michael Clayton.
So, it came out in 2007. Is that right?
Yes.
2007. So this would have been a rental, most likely from somewhere, because of 2007, there would have been no way I would have gone to the movie. So this must have been something I saw either on Netflix or on some kind of cable rental. But I'd heard about it, but And I like George Clooney just fine. So I thought, yeah, it seems like a thriller and the preview looked good. So I just watched it one day and I actually kind of liked it. So I wasn't sure what to make of the movie when I watched it the first time. And rewatching it the other night, I didn't remember big parts of it, but I still enjoyed it. So
Brother Drew, had you seen this movie before?
Yes, I also saw it when it came out on video. And I don't remember how this movie was marketed, but I do remember being quite surprised when I watched the movie, because it is freaking dark and bleak and pessimistic and cynical. And that was not what I was expecting. And George Clooney is, he's not a hero. And Tilda Swinton is freaking weird.
Yeah, she is. She won an Academy Award for this movie.
Oh, did she?
She deserved it. She was great.
Actually, I think everybody was nominated for an Academy Award for this movie.
It's well deserved. Yeah. So I was like Jason. I was really thrown for a loop watching this because it was not at all what I expected. But yeah, no, this movie was completely unexpected, but fantastic. So many great performances. A real turn, I think, for George Clooney. Had we seen him in anything sort of this unlikable before?
I don't think so.
Yeah, not that I recall.
This also kind of is, I don't know what the years, how many years different this is, but this is a nice turn into the American land.
Yes. The American, our most underrated episode of all of our episodes. Still upset about it.
It's a good movie, though.
Go download the American episode and listen to it. It's great.
In fact, downloaded it on several different devices to make Drew happy about numbers.
So, good night and good luck. It wasn't really dark, was it?
He's more of a hero figure in that.
All right.
And he's not up front. Like he's up front in this movie. He stars this movie. He didn't star Good Night and Good Luck.
He was in The Thin Red Line.
I never saw that movie. Didn't seem like something I'd want to see.
Not a fan.
I watched this as a rental, I think. I don't think I saw it. I could have seen it in the theater, but I don't think so, actually. And this is a sneaky movie. Because it's very mellow for how dark it is. The action that it has is few and far between, but it's effective.
Well, and the opening kind of gives you a misdirection that you don't expect. It makes you expect a turn that turned completely differently than I had expected, which I think is on purpose, of course.
What, did you expect him to go all Jason Bourne after the car bomb?
Well, I did. I expected
I
him
did
to
too.
Just, yeah. I expected him to go on the warpath.
Well, and that's the thing, is that the movie takes a couple different... It takes some things which should have been obvious, like a lesser-type thriller movie could have used all these same beats, but not quite as deftly handled. Like the fact that he owes money to these loan sharks.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's a kind of a subtle thing. It's a thing, and it's a source of tension. But you realize that it's not. Even though he has a gambling problem, he doesn't owe this money to these loan sharks because he's a degenerate gambler. And the problem never gets solved in a satisfying way. Actually, nothing about this movie ends in a satisfying way, really, except for one part of it.
That's maybe fair.
Yeah. Shall we just dive in then?
Yep.
And again, I recommend seeing this movie. If you guys haven't seen this movie out there, go watch the movie.
It's well worth a watch.
Yeah, I think you'll enjoy it even if we do spoil it for you, but this is one of those ones where, as most thrillers are, go experience it. So if you haven't seen it and don't know anything about it, go into it with that.
It's worth it for the performances alone.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Do either of you off the top of your head know how long this movie was?
That's a good 2 hours.
Is it? Because I thought it moved really fast. It was nicely paced.
I thought so too.
1 hour 59.
Nice. Yeah.
And it made plenty of money.
Good.
As well it should.
Budget of approximately $25 million. Gross domestic $49 million. Cumulative worldwide $92 million.
Before we get into the plot, let's talk about this year, the 2008 Academy Awards.
That's the No Country for Old Men, There Will Be Blood year, right?
Is it? Well, let's find out. Because, are you looking it up? Okay, yeah. Because this is one of the few, this movie got a ton of nominations in different categories, and not very many other movies that year did. Like, there wasn't, like, four big movies that got nominated for everything. It was more like there were a lot of movies that got nominated for a couple things.
So, Best Picture, Atonement, Juno, Michael Clayton, There Will Be Blood, No Country for Old Men.
Best Actor, who is that?
George Clooney, Johnny Depp, Tommy Lee Jones, Viggo Mortensen, Daniel Day-Lewis.
And Daniel Day-Lewis
won? Johnny Depp?
Johnny Depp for Sweeney Todd.
That's terrible.
So did Daniel Day-Lewis win?
Yes.
For?
There Will Be Blood.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, okay, yeah. And then who was the best supporting actress? Tilda Swinton won, but who was she up against?
Cate Blanchett for I'm Not There. Ruby Dee for American Gangster. Saoirse Ronan. I'm sure I butchered that one. Saoirse Ronan, Atonement. And Amy Ryan for Gone Baby Gone.
I think it's closer to like Saoirse.
Oh, is it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Oh, and Best Supporting Actors? Casey Affleck for The Assassination of Jesse James. Mm. Philip Seymour Hoffman for Charlie Wilson's War. Hal Holbrook for Into the Wild. Tom Wilkinson for Michael Clayton. And Javier Bardem for No Country for Old Men.
And Bardem won?
Yes.
Okay.
I think Wilkinson might be better.
Yeah.
Yeah. Original screenplay, Juno, Lars and the Real Girl, Michael Clayton, Ratatouille, and the Savages.
Who won that? Juno?
Juno.
So, is that, don't tell
Diablo
me.
Cody.
Diablo Cody, she won an Oscar?
Yes.
Wow, good for her.
Best Director? Julian Schnabel, The Diving Bell and the Butterfly, Jason Reitman, Juno, Tony Gilroy, Michael Clayton, Paul Thomas Anderson, There Will Be Blood, Joel Coen and Ethan Coen, No Country for Old Men.
Definitely, There Will Be Blood.
The Coen brothers. Yes.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
For No Country. Yeah, I don't think Paul Thomas Anderson has an Oscar.
Interesting.
Best Adapted Screenplay, There Will Be Blood, Paul Thomas Anderson, The Diving Bell, Ronald Harwood, Away From Her, Sarah Polley, Atonement, Christopher Hampton, No Country for Old Men.
Wait, Sarah Polley adapted a screenplay?
Mm-hmm.
That's a great movie. That is another movie that's really hard to watch.
Away From Her?
Yeah. I think she directed it, too. She wrote and directed it.
Oh, wow.
Julie Christie, I want to say.
Oh, okay.
Should put it on the list.
I don't want
to
watch it.
Yeah, if it's hard to watch, maybe we...
I don't want to watch it again.
Okay, well, fair enough.
It's about Alzheimer's, by the way.
Yeah, I'm good. Best original song that year, Falling Slowly from Once, won it.
Good deal.
That was a loaded year for movies.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. There were a lot of movies that were really good, so it kind of got spread around.
Best sound mixing, Transformers, 310 to Yuma, Ratatouille, No Country for Old Men, The Bourne Ultimatum.
The Bourne Ultimatum? Who won that? Okay.
The Bourne Ultimatum.
I can say. And this is an interesting thriller in that it's not an action movie, so it's not like a summer action movie or a Christmas action movie. But it's
kind of a
like
suspense thriller.
Yeah, but it's not like an Oscar bait movie either, although there was performances obviously worthy of Oscars.
Well, you have like the Oscar bait speech, but you don't get to see it performed. It's just voiceover. So, yeah, you don't even get that chance. But it opened the movie.
Oh, yeah. It's a great speech. If I were ever to give a monologue to apply for a school of dramatic arts, I think this would be the monologue I'd pick. In either that or the I Am God monologue.
Would you undress while you were doing it?
He didn't have to. That's the beauty of it. It's awesome. So, yeah. So the movie opens with this monologue by Tom Wilkinson where he's like a raving lunatic.
Michael. Dear Michael. Of course it's you. Who else could they send? Who else could be trusted?
And I know it's a long way and you're ready to go to work. All I'm saying is wait. Just wait. Just please hear me out because this is not an episode. Relapse. Fuck up. I'm begging you, Michael. I'm begging you. Try and make believe this is not just madness because this is not just madness. 2 weeks ago, I came out of the building, okay? I'm running across 6th Avenue. There's a car waiting. I got exactly 38 minutes to get to the airport, and I'm dictating. There's this panicked associate sprinting along beside me, scribbling in a notepad, and suddenly she starts screaming, and I realize we're standing in the middle of the street, the lights change, and there's this wall of traffic, serious traffic, speeding towards us, and I freeze. I can't move. And I'm suddenly consumed with the overwhelming sensation that I'm covered with some sort of film. And it's in my hair, my face, and it's like a glaze, like a coating. And at first I thought, my God, I know what this is. This is some sort of amniotic embryonic fluid. I'm drenched in afterbirth. I've breached the chrysalis. I've been reborn. But then the traffic, the stampede, the cars, the trucks, the horns, the boom, and screaming, and I'm thinking, no, reset. This is not rebirth. This is some kind of giddy illusion of renewal that happens in the final moment before death. And then I realize, no, this is completely wrong because I look back at the building. And I had the most stunning moment of clarity. I realized, Michael, that I had emerged not through the doors of Kenner, Bach, and Lundin, not through the portals of our vast and powerful law firm, but from the asshole of an organism whose sole function is to excrete the poison, the ammo, the defoliant necessary for other, larger, more powerful organisms to destroy the miracle of humanity. And that I had been coded in this patina of shit for the best part of my life. The stench of it and the stain of it would in all likelihood take the rest of my life to undo. And you know what I did? I took a deep cleansing breath and I set that notion aside. I tabled it. I said to myself, as clear as this may be, as potent a feeling as this is, as true a thing as I believe that I have witnessed today, it must wait. It must stand the test of time. And Michael, the time is now.
And then you kind of skip over that and go to what's kind of opening credit sort of area. And then you go and you see this law office with these dozens of people all taking phone calls. And we learn that there's Marty Bach, played by Sidney Pollack, who actually wanted to direct this movie. And when he was approached about acting in it, and Gilroy's like, no, I bought this so I could direct it. He's like, okay.
Well, that's, there you go.
But I always like seeing Sidney Pollack. I don't know about you guys, but
yeah,
he was really good.
Yeah, he's always good. Anyway, he also plays a good, not necessarily bad guy, but completely without morals guy.
Yeah, I mean, this is essentially the same character as Eyes Wide Shut, right? Yeah,
pretty much, yep.
Just he's a lawyer instead of a doctor.
Yeah. So he's one of the partners in this big law firm, and the Wall Street Journal is calling to ask him for this news about a settlement in this big case. And he's like, no, you North is not settling at this time. And then we see Karen Crowder, Tilda Swinton, and she is rehearsing. She's actually having a panic attack in a bathroom at this point.
Yes.
But what they do with her is very interesting in this movie. That's why she got the Academy Award, I think. Not only because her performances are great, but she had a lot of interesting things to do. Like the fact that you have her practicing the speech intercut with her actually giving like the interview is really interesting.
Yeah, and the way she did it and sort of the choices she made while she was practicing and what she ended up with made it super creepy.
Yes. But also, it made you sympathetic toward her. because to her plight about getting ready to give an interview, at least I did, as far as she's trying to get these phrases right, trying to practice it, and she's not perfect at it, and she's getting frustrated. And I mean, I guess not sympathy. I empathize with her plight. How about that?
Okay. Yeah. So I can see that. Yeah. She was like full on like immoral politician.
Oh yeah. No, you're right. Sympathetic is the wrong word. She's not a sympathetic character, but and then we see George Clooney, who is Michael Clayton, and he's at a poker game, like this like underground poker
back room,
yeah,
restaurant, smoky venue, crazy after hours, divey underground place.
Yeah, where they're probably playing for a pretty high stakes. And you got this guy mouthing off to him about, hey, I remember you. I want a bunch of money from you.
Do you know who that was?
I did, but I didn't write his name down.
Fellow podcaster, Brian Koppelman.
What podcast does Brian Koppelman do?
I forget what it's called. But it's like an interview podcast. He's probably better known for writing the movie Rounders.
Okay.
And creating the show Billions.
Okay. So you have this good exchange. Well, it's sort of, there's no real exchange. I mean, George Clooney is sort of just taking all this abuse without giving anything back. And then when he finally gives something back, it's pretty low rent and not very effective. And then he leaves the poker game, seemingly not successfully. And he's getting a phone call on his way out.
Well, he doesn't get a phone call on his way out. He gets interrupted.
Yeah, okay. So he gets interrupted by his phone, which is actually sequestered right in another area. So he leaves the game at that point, and he's got to go talk to a client. And we learn that he is not he's an attorney, but he's not a like trial lawyer. He's a fixer, or as he calls it at one point, a janitor. He just cleans up messes. He knows how to get things done, which is actually, it's a good time in history to talk about lawyers like this. One of them is in the news and probably will be for some time. That would be one Michael Cohen, an attorney with maybe three clients or maybe one client. It's hard to say, but so he's a fixer. So he is sent to fix a situation where a very rich guy tells him that, yeah, he hit and ran this person, probably killed this person, and now he needs to figure out how to get out of it. And George Clooney is like, you need to find a trial lawyer. And so you have this great tense scene where the guy's like, well, why are you even here? You're supposed to be a miracle worker. And that's when he describes it. He's not a miracle worker. He's a janitor. And you made a mess that is difficult to clean. It's very easy. What you did was a very simple crime to solve.
Oh, and I love the wife in this scene. I don't think she has any speaking lines, right?
I don't think so.
But she was great. Like just her reactions in the background, and then when she finally loses her shit and throws the glass.
A little bit dramatic.
Yeah.
Melodramatic.
Seemed appropriate, though.
Yeah, and so, you know, so Michael Clayton does this thing, and it is not satisfying to him, because it's not something it's not a problem he can solve, and he's already had a bad time playing poker, and so he's driving in his car at night, looking pretty, he's having a bad movie. Michael Clayton never has a good time in this movie.
Oh, and we find out later why he's so seemingly dejected while he's trying to deal with his client, and it's because he had to sell his soul to the firm.
Yes.
To get out from under the loan shark, and what
he hates what his job too.
Yeah, and what that ended up happening is he used to be sort of the fixer, mainly for stuff for. What was his name? Marty? The Sidney Pollack character?
Yes.
Yes.
Right? And part of the deal to get the bonus was now he had to answer to the other douchebag who he genuinely hated.
Yeah.
And that's who called him in to do this job. So that's why he maybe wasn't really giving it his all.
Yeah. Yeah. He's not having a good time. He doesn't, we find out that he does not enjoy his job and maybe hasn't for quite some time.
Yeah, but he's damned because he's good at it.
Yeah. Yeah. And because his escape parachute has failed.
And he has a schmuck of a brother.
Yeah. Well, we don't know any of this yet. What we know is that his very expensive but leased car has a GPS that's glitching out. So it's driving along after this little glitch thing.
And he does the dad thing.
Where he smashes on the dash.
He just smacks the top of the dash with his fist.
Yeah. Seems like the thing to do.
Yeah. Like it were a television from our childhood,
yeah,
where the V-hold wouldn't straighten up.
I'm trying to think if I have ever done that particular thing. I don't think so.
Oh, you know you have.
Well, no, I'm sure I have done other things. I'm trying to think of if beating on a dash would have been something that would have occurred to me. I would probably push a bunch of buttons, but yeah. Never really thought about that before, so we'll see. Next time I smash on something to see if it'll work, I will let you know. Stay tuned. So he's driving along at night and sees, or I guess it's what, dusk now or dawn, I guess. And he's driving on this back road, country road sort of thing. And he sees these like horses up standing by themselves in the field. And he is, this catches his fancy. And so he just parks his car on the side of the road and gets out and goes and looks at the horses. And while he's in this magical, like literally pastoral scene, his car explodes. And dun-dun.
Not once.
Yeah.
But like three times.
Yeah. So his GPS was really glitching out. I mean, that's not normally what would happen after you start to see the little... So then, dun-dun. Now something's afoot. And he gets this great look on his face. Kind of like an Alfred Hitchcock type character. Like, oh shit, this is bigger than I thought it was going to be. And or I'm having a worse day than I thought this was going to be. And then we go to 4 days earlier.
It's just not my day.
Yeah, where we learn that Michael Clayton, among other things, is a divorced dad. And he picks up his son to take to school. And his son chit-chats with him about this book he's reading. This book that, by the way, was called Realm and Conquest.
Yes.
That Gilroy spent a lot of time fleshing out this book because it's symbolic of all these things in this movie. So I thought that was a nice little feature that they threw in there, how Michael Clayton's journey kind of mirrors the journey in this book. Anyway, this is where you see Tilda Swinton's character, who is like a head executive for U-North, which is a tremendously large corporate agricultural conglomerate a la Monsanto. That's what I thought. And we're cutting back and forth between her preparing for and actually giving an interview with her boss, Don Jeffries, played by Ken Howard. And again, maybe because of she's so anxious, I sort of identified with this. She's all getting ready and it like shows her like actually getting dressed for it. So she's not, like it shows like a real middle-aged woman getting dressed, like how like inglorious that looks. It's not a glamorous series of shots. You know what I mean? Just looks like a real person, which I thought was interesting. And during this interview, an assistant comes in and interrupts them because of an important development has happened. And the important development is the narrator from the first, the crazed narrator from the beginning, Tom Wilkinson. He is like the head lawyer, like the main guy in this super prestigious firm, the main litigator in this firm that Sidney Pollack is part of. And, he has just had a complete breakdown during a deposition where he actually ends up like going off the deep end, professing his love for a client and disrobing and following that client naked into the parking lot. Oh, and this is a class action suit worth billions of dollars. And then we cut back to Michael Clayton, who we see him And the property in his restaurant is getting auctioned off.
That is such a brutal scene.
It is.
And also the U-North stuff, it kind of sets you up as the viewer, right? It sort of makes you feel like this might be like an Aaron Brockovich movie or like a civil action.
Exactly. Yes, yes.
And it turns out it's not. It's definitely not one of those movies.
No. And we see Michael Clayton is in serious debt. And in the synopsis that IMDb has, it talks about his gambling debts. But my impression was this is not his gambling debts necessarily. This is his, well, that may have contributed, but that wasn't explained. This is the fact that he has invested in this restaurant that has failed.
Well, I think the point is made that they're trying to say that basically they're all a family of addicts. Each one of them just has a different addiction, and they're all kind of suffering the aftermath of their own addiction that they all kind of keep suffering from and falling into. Michael repeatedly says, I'm not doing that anymore. I'm not doing that. I haven't done it. Which it's like, well, we just saw you.
No. You saw him afterward.
Later. Yeah. No, I understand what I'm saying.
Yeah. What you saw is his last ditch effort.
Yeah, I got the impression he was broke because of his gambling.
Yes.
But he went into debt to the loan shark to open up this restaurant bar with his brother.
His brother who has drug problems and was somehow dooming the restaurant because of that.
But by the point that he's at the poker game, he's already paid back the loan sharks.
Yes.
Yes. But again, he's got nothing else to lose, right? He might as well start drinking and getting back into gambling and do whatever he wants. He sold his soul. I think that may have been kind of a red herring too, because his problems are not gambling problems. He's got other problems, yeah. Anyway, he gets called in to talk to Marty, who tells him about the situation with Arthur Eden, who is Tom Wilkinson. We find out that Arthur and Michael have had encounters before. They know each other, maybe quite well. And Arthur is a big deal. Arthur is the senior litigator in this gigantic, really huge, prestigious law firm. But he also has bipolar disorder and has gone off his meds at least one time previously. And Michael had to babysit him during that time. This was a more spectacular going off his meds, and this would be harder to fix for a fixer. But at the very least, Michael's going to come and take Arthur and put him in a hotel room until he can get back on his meds and try to clean up the mess from that way.
Yeah, and at this point, you can tell he's really good at cleaning up the mess because he thinks of all the details. Getting Arthur in a safe place. He's trying to track down to see if they can have any control over the video. They can't. Then he tries, he asks where Arthur's briefcase is. He knows that's important. Nobody has it. Turns out Tilda Swinton has it. So he's obviously very good in a crisis like this.
Yeah. Plus, his dad and his brother are cops, so he knows everybody too. He's got all the connections. He is. That's what his. That's why he's a fixer, is because he knows how to reach out and pull strings behind the scenes. So, and we find out that
and he used to be a DA, right?
Yeah,
an assistant DA.
Yep. And his official title, he's actually part of the wills and trust department in the law firm, and has been for 17 years. Again, it's. Nothing is quite what it seems in this movie. And yet that may be just a reflection of what life is like. By the way, I'm still trying to find the next parallax view for me, and I haven't found it yet.
Oh, good luck with that.
But I did buy an audiobook called Winter Kills. It is another novel by the guy Richard Condon, who wrote The Manchurian Candidate. And it's sort of... It's based on a situation similar to the the Kennedy assassination, where it would be like if Bobby Kennedy got in, was contacted by the gunman on the grassy knoll, like 15 years after the Kennedy assassination. So we'll see where that goes. It's a 1972 or 74 book, so it's going to reek of the 70s.
Yeah, so a Parallax View nowadays, that would be a TV show, right?
Yeah, probably. Yeah,
something like Rubicon? Or
yeah. Yeah.
The Americans?
Yeah.
Probably. Oh, man. Yeah, The Americans.
But by the way, I'm on... I still have my cable box from the Olympics because I'd been a fat, lazy bastard and haven't taken my cable box back to the cable company. And we can watch the last season of The Americans on pay-per-view on demand for free.
Nice.
But only for the next, like, 2 weeks. So now we're scrambling to finish the episodes. But holy shit, it's brutal. We're only, like, 2 episodes in and it's brutal.
Oh, of the final season?
Yeah.
Yeah, it only gets worse.
Oh my god.
Yeah. So, yeah, good luck marathoning that.
Yeah, if you or the listeners can find a grand conspiracy novel, cuz I was looking for novels or movies actually, but novels especially, and I'm looking for I started looking through at political thrillers. I don't want political thrillers where the main character is like a government assassin or rogue sniper or anything. It's just not my normal thing. Although it does make me think of David Morrell and how much I appreciate his earlier works.
Something in the same vein, although you sort of know how it turns out. The Looming Tower is actually really good. I don't know if you've watched any of that.
The Looming Tower?
Yeah, it's on Hulu.
What's it about?
It's about the lead up to 9/11 and the different intelligence agencies that were involved.
Well, the thing about the Parallax View is the reason why it appeals to me is because it's got that Lovecraft element where the conspiracy...
They're brainwashing him?
No, the conspiracy is so big. And you never quite, you only see the edges of it. You never quite figure out, or it's never explained how big or how deep or how wide it is. It's not easily explained. So it's just gigantic looming threat that you can't quite get your head around. And that's all the best Lovecraft stories that have that in common, I think. That whole knowledge thing, like the more you find out about how things really are, the crazier you get because you can't actually comprehend what it's all about. I like that sort of thing. That appeals to me.
Well, that's cheery.
No, but it's Arthur. That's Arthur's thing in this movie too, is he's had this personal revelation and you think he's a crazy person. And then you realize that, well, yes, but also no. but we'll get there. So Michael goes and takes Arthur and puts him in a hotel and says, you're going to get better. Take your pills. And he chastises him for going off the deep end. And Arthur's like, look, this is a real big deal. You know, this is more important. The fact that the speech goes, Michael Clayton says, you're the senior litigating partner on one of the largest, most respected law firms in the world. You are a legend. Arthur's like, I'm an accomplice. Michael Clayton's like, you're a manic depressive. And Arthur's like, I am Shiva, the god of death. I'm like, okay. Anyway, so Michael like takes Arthur and he thinks it's going to be fine. And Michael's got a lot of things to do in the background. He's got to find the briefcase. He's got to try to put out all the fires. He's got to still deal with the fact that he's a father and has all of these responsibilities.
He's got to meet with the client.
And probably track down and find out if the person in the deposition that Arthur has declared his love for, what the hell is going to happen with that. It's all very complicated.
Oops.
Because again, Arthur is in the law firm representing Monsanto, and this person he has declared his love for is a young woman who is a victim of Monsanto. By the way, it turns out it's sort of a MacGuffin, but this whole Monsanto subplot thing, this U-North is the name of the company here. If there are Monsanto executives listening to our podcast, as unlikely as it might be, I'm not suggesting they are at fault or their pesticides cause cancer or anything. Although that's one of those global conspiracies that you can get into if you want to, depending on if you're an heirloom farmer or not with heirloom seeds. So, U-North, huge conglomerate that does agricultural stuff. Their pesticide is great, except that it causes cancer, and there is evidence that they knew about it. So that's where it becomes the civil matter, the Aaron Brockovich sort of thing. So Arthur knows that this document exists. The other players don't know it exists quite yet, but this is apparently what has caused Arthur to go over the edge. It's like, oh yeah, he's got evidence that he is working for the bad guys. And now he has seen these victims as just horrible victims, and he is representing the other half, and it's broken his brain. So Michael then has to go talk to Crowder, who is Tilda Swinton, and try to explain the situation. She's like, no, we're paying your firm a shit ton of money. And this can't happen. This is horrible, and this is a problem. Then we see Crowder go back and watch the video. This is the first time we get to see a video of the deposition where Arthur is going crazy and starting to take his clothes off. It's pretty impressive and horrifying. And I like the look on Tilda Swinton's face when she realizes how horrifying the whole thing is.
She's so good in this movie.
She is. She really is. And yes, she is a weirdo. It's like she's a little bit like Helena Bonham Carter, where you think she really enjoys putting on ugly faces.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
But she can pull it off, just like Helena Bonham Carter.
Have either of you seen Okja?
I have not.
No, not yet.
I think this is a prequel for Tilda Swinton for Okja.
You've seen Stormpiercer?
Snowpiercer?
Snowpiercer, sorry, yeah.
I have not.
Oh, it's a different kind of Tilda Swinton role. But
it's been on the calendar for years.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's worth watching. We'll get to it. Anyway, so then we go get Michael's son, Henry, who's on the phone talking about this book that he's already told Michael about. And he's talking to Arthur, who's laying in bed, fascinated by this book because the book has all sorts of these heroes are having visions. They are summoned to this area because they are part of this master plot, but they don't understand what the plot is, and they don't know that they know they have been summoned, but they don't know that each other has been summoned. So,
and none of them know why they're supposed to bring so much bread.
So anyway, yeah. So it's, and Arthur is like taking vigorous notes because he is a crazy person. And so he's putting these things together that may not have anything to do with each other.
Yeah. It's feeding right into his manic episode.
Yeah. It's great. And it's perfect. I mean, it's so skillfully done. It seems like it's an easy trick to pull off, but if you've ever talked to crazy people or paranoid people or delusional people, and I'm not talking about family members, but, you know, other people, you realize that they find connections in places that there may not actually be connections, let's say.
You may not see the connections.
Exactly, yeah. But again, something about this appeals to me because I really would like to think that in a parallax view sense that, oh, sure, it is all connected. If you're sitting in the middle of the night at the Sullivan Arena parking lot and there's a reader board that says, Pay and Save show you the way at the Show Me How Fair, then your next stop is to go to Pay and Save because that's where the solution to your problem is.
Sing doo-wah-diddy.
So we have this whole the thing where Arthur then tells Michael that he has to go see Anna, this woman at the deposition. And Michael's like, no, 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 no. We're going back to New York. And so Arthur manages an escape from the hotel room. And now we have another problem for Michael to solve. He's got to track down Arthur. So at this point, we know Arthur's briefcase is missing. And now we find out that Tilda Swinton has it because she's got mysterious people in the background helping her. She got a team of fixers on their own. Not lawyers, but operators, let's say. And so now she has seen what Arthur has been looking at, including this very, very damaging document. Like a $1 billion document
Yeah, that no one else has seen because they had a, I'm using finger quotes here, they had a warehouse fire that destroyed a lot of their archives.
Yes, yes. Now we have people's hands starting to get dirty. Tilda Swinton, among them, has the dirtiest hands because she's starting to set these things in motion. She needs to make sure that no one sees this document. Anybody who has seen this document doesn't talk about seeing this document. And when you have a crazy person who has been the custodian of this document, who is going to blow the lid off things, that provides a problem for you, North. So, in the meantime, Michael goes back to talk to Sidney Pollack, and Sidney Pollack is not happy because, A, this his whole law firm could come crumbling down, and B, they're trying to, have a merger or they're being acquired or something.
Yeah, their law firm is being integrated into a larger company.
Which would make them all very rich. At least the partners. Not Michael.
Potentially.
Yeah.
Yeah, it'll make the partners rich and it makes everyone scared for their job.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And if this doesn't go through, that is a whole nother problem, which is also make you scared for your job, yeah. So and also, Sidney Pollack is not happy because Michael just should have had Arthur committed. and Michael's like, that's not what I do. He doesn't need to be committed. And by the way, Pollack is having none of it. He's like, look, like we have hundreds of lawyers here. Doesn't somebody, find out somebody knows a shit ton about committing procedures and get him committed. And Michael's like, yeah, you know who that is? That's Arthur. The guy you're trying to commit. And later we get a demonstration that Arthur may be crazy, but he also does remember these rules about commitment. So once he's returned to New York, sorry, he's not eligible.
That is my favorite scene in the whole movie.
When they're arguing with the baguettes in the alleyway.
Yes, there's so much going on in that scene, and I love every part of it.
Take one of those loaves and hit him with it. Bread fight.
So now we have flashbacks for another reason. I can't see because my glasses are broken. So we have Arthur, who's super paranoid, but we also find out that Tilda Swinton is having him spied on. So he has reason to be paranoid. They are out to get him. And the net is growing tighter. Michael's got to try to find Arthur before the bad guys do. And all this time, he actually goes to visit in Minnesota or whatever, the farm girl who Arthur is infatuated with. And she is herself is kind of a piece of work. She still lives with her parents or sister or somebody, right?
Her sister, yeah. She's very simple.
Yes. Naive and believes Arthur is a friendly, helpful guy. But Arthur tries to contact Anna over the phone and gets her to come to New York. And she does, because, again, she's simple. And this is where Sidney Pollack tells Michael that Arthur tried to contact Anna, and now it's that, okay, he's not going to go away. Now we have to go find him and make this stop. So that's where we have the confrontation in the street with the bread. And Michael's trying to talk sense into Arthur, but he's having none of it. But again, there's, as you said, there's a lot going on.
One thing I noticed this time that probably wouldn't have affected me the same way the first time I watched it 10 years ago was it was adding so much more tension for me that he left his kid in the car.
Yes.
And every time they cut to a shot of Clooney, like just the tail end of his car was in the background like a giant red herring. And I kept expecting something bad to happen to the car. The car starts to drive away.
Yes.
And it was filling me with dread.
Oh, yeah. Because, again, there are people, sinister forces working in the background.
Yeah. And this was such a brilliant scene for Tom Wilkinson. He showed so much range in this one scene. I mean, he went all the way from kind of like a kind of jittery, ticky, crazy person. And then he makes that turn at the end, which was just chilling. When he starts talking about how Michael blew his chance to have him committed.
Oh yeah, and he's laying down the law with Michael too about who Michael is in the world also. He's like, look, I may be the bad guy, but you are also a bad guy.
Yeah, he says you're just the bag man.
Yeah.
Oh, this is by far my favorite scene in the movie. And he's got this bouquet of baguettes, which is just so weird.
Yes. He's all got this tremendous amount of bread. I didn't remember what you were talking about when you said that the heroes are bringing all this bread.
Yeah, so that was distracting. The car was distracting. And then Arthur does this little rope-a-dope, like, oh, I'm just kind of a tottering old guy. Oh, by the way, I'm way smarter than you, and you fucked up. You lost your chance, and now I'm going to destroy you all.
Exactly. Yeah, because Arthur's mission now is to burn down his master's house. And he starts that mission by calling and leaving himself a message, right?
I don't know who's calling.
Yeah, I think he's leaving somebody at the law firm a message, but he thinks he's being monitored, which he is. His phones are being tapped. And so he starts reading off of this paper and giving self-annotation to it in a great way.
Not in a creepy way.
No, but then something bad happens to Arthur.
Womp womp.
Yeah, he commits suicide.
By somebody murdering him.
Yeah, by being murdered by the henchman of Tilda Swinton.
After Tilda Swinton danced around like a crazy woman trying to get them to say that they would assassinate him without her saying that they were going to assassinate
him. Well, exactly. Exactly.
That was another brilliant scene. Both Tilda Swinton and whoever that dude was were great in just...
Because he was like, no, we don't do that. We would just question him. And then that's it.
Yeah.
What else is there?
What about other things? Yeah. He's like, are you telling me to initiate other things? Or are you just asking me if there are other things that might exist? Yeah. So Arthur's now is dead. And Michael's like, hold on. This is way more than just somebody's suicide. There is something going on here. And this is where Clayton goes to a family gathering where we meet his brothers. One of whom is a cop, and the other one is his druggy brother, Timmy. And there's a uncomfortable interaction between Timmy and Michael in front of Michael's son.
Followed by an uncomfortable interaction between Michael and his son.
Yes.
Yeah, where he stops the car.
Yeah, and it's like a good dad moment, but under the circumstances, it just felt really creepy.
Oh, yeah. Exactly.
It gave me flashbacks.
Yeah, like he's talking about his brother, but he's also really talking about himself.
Mm-hmm.
And hoping that his son just has a better time in life and sort of trying to speak it into existence.
And so Michael's got to do some stuff here, pull some strings, do some fixing on his own. And things start to go awry. He's got all this pressure, you know, but he does talk to his brother Ray about getting in to Arthur's apartment. Arthur's apartment is a crime scene, right? It's a suicide, whatever.
Yep.
So there's a seal over the
sealed
door. Yeah. So he needs another seal because he's going to break the first seal. So he breaks into the apartment, and this is where he finds his Arthur's copy of the book his son has been talking about, with all these highlighted and underlined passages and a receipt from a photocopy store.
Like a Kinko's.
And then he's arrested, which gets himself into trouble, but also gets his brother into trouble. His brother is not happy about that, because his brother could lose his pension.
Yeah.
So all of a sudden, Michael's the shithead brother, too. Yeah, I feel bad for the cop brother. It's like, oh, crap. But, so Ray, his brother, gets Michael out of jail, but he's pissed off. And then Michael goes to the printing place and finds out that there are 3,000 copies of this confidential report.
And it had a weird title, right? In the vein of Roman Conquer.
And they can only do half of them in the red cover that he requested, like the Realm and Conquer book. The other half are in blue. So Michael finds out that, okay, this is what this is. He's like, well, that's interesting. Hold on to these for me. I'm not going to pick them up right now from my van because I wasn't expecting to pick up 3,000 bound copies of something. Unfortunately, the bad guys are now tailing Michael too, so they find out what's going on. And that's where Crowder talks to, you know, is getting deeper and deeper into what she wants done. And this is where Clayton also meets with Michael, talks to Sidney Pollack about and asks for the $80,000 he needs. He needs $75,000 to pay off this loan to the loan sharks in 2 weeks. So he's going to get kneecapped or whatever. And Pollack's like, sure. But by the way, you have to also sign a new 3-year contract with a new secrecy clause. And that also is retroactive, and now you report to that douchebag guy. So he is really selling his soul for $80,000.
And his dignity and his self-respect.
Yeah. So he goes and pays off the loan shark guy, which is a surprise to everyone, including the loan shark guy. Or he's the intermediary, right? And theoretically, he's paid off the $75,000 and takes the last $5,000, and he's gambling with that $5,000, right?
All right.
And that's where we meet up with the beginning of the story. While he's playing the card game, they are wiring his car to explode.
That was pretty tense.
Yeah. And then he has his pulling over. He thinks he's being followed, right? He's doing some evasive maneuvers, isn't he?
I didn't get that he thought he was being followed. I thought he was just kind of losing his shit.
Yeah, I think he was just pissed off.
So when he goes off to the side road and then looks at the horses and they detonate the bomb because they're gonna lose him. Again, this is another in a lesser done movie. This could have been a cheesy point, but it actually worked pretty well. That nobody in this movie is perfect in their jobs. They're all good at their jobs, but nobody's perfect. So shit comes up.
The henchmen kind of. They're less than they're not quite as thorough as they should be to perform their job to its peak efficiency.
Well, yeah, they're not criminal masterminds. They're just, you know, they're bag men too.
Yeah, I mean, but they were so like good and tactical when they took care of Arthur. But then when they're trying to take care of Michael, they're just like, I don't know, fuck it, blow it up now.
Yeah, exactly. Because their life is, you know, their mission is unraveling too. Everybody is unraveling in this movie. So yeah. So now we have Michael's car blows up and he's freaking out. So he decides just in a split second, he's going to throw his watch and his wallet and a bunch of stuff inside the car to look like he blew up in the car.
That's kind of genius, by the way.
Kind of. Except you think there would be some human remains that you'd expect to find in there. But we find out that he calls his brother Timmy to pick him up. Timmy bails him out, which makes Timmy feel good. So back at the firm, everybody's sad about Michael's car blowing up. Really, really sad and scary.
All of a sudden, U North is settling.
Yes,
this giant lawsuit too.
Yep, and it's actually, Tilda Swinton. She wants to be the devil, but she's at least working for the devil because she presents it to the board of directors that, oh yeah, you know, this settlement. It's going to be a huge amount of money, but not too terribly. And because it's going to be like a tax write-off, it'll pay for itself.
Yeah, that scene is soul crushing for the audience.
Exactly. Yes. Yes.
Because it is so dark and cynical. Because it's not just, if we do it this year, we can write it off and it'll pay for itself. It's also like we have an intel on the plaintiff's lawyer's fee structure, and we've figured out just the perfect sweet spot to incentivize them to yes. recommend settling because it'll maximize their fee at a cost that minimizes our exposure. And it just felt so real. I'm sure these conversations happen, and it's just so dark and pessimistic and just makes you just hate anybody who works for a giant corporation.
Well, and so this is, you alluded to this before, but this is not the ending that we're going to talk about in just a second. It's not the Aaron Brockovich ending. It's not the, like, the John Grisham ending. It's not the, it's not the Michael Clayton saves the day ending that you'd say, here, I'm going to send all of these to, like, the New York New York Times and the Wall Street Journal and CNN and stuff and expose UNorth to this huge thing. No, no. Michael Clayton is basically going to trap Crowder because he's so pissed that Crowder tried to have him killed, which is the beautiful final. I love Michael Clayton's speech at the end because it all comes down to very small, but very personal, but very small beans. He's mm-hmm. he's like, you already paid. I already got paid off. I'm not the guy who killed that you try to kill. I'm the guy you pay off. Like, I've already been paid off a very small amount of money to sell my soul. You don't need to kill me. But now, because you tried to kill me, now I'm going to open up a can of whoop ass, but not for the good guys. I'm just going to get you. Because at the end of this movie, he has set up Tilda Swinton as a murderer, and maybe there's some sort of conspiracy in there too, but she's not going to, I mean, UNorth isn't part of the issue. She is personally the issue. And Michael Clayton doesn't get much out of it. In fact, at the end of it, he thanks the police because he has this confrontation with Tilda Swinton. Although I think my favorite line is when he's like, she sees him, he's like, you're supposed to be dead. He's like, yeah, I'm not. And Arthur's running around here somewhere. Kind of funny. And he gets to repeat he's Shiva, god of death, to her, which is nice. But at the end, he gets into a cab. The cab driver, by the way, is the director. And he just gives the cab $50 and tells him to drive. It doesn't matter where. And you have this lingering look on George Clooney's face.
I know that look. That's the look of, I still have to go back to work.
Exactly. Well,
except I think it was great because his expression changes if you watch the whole thing. He starts really dejected and exhausted and drained, but by the end of it, he's smiling.
Is he?
Looks like it.
Grimace. Yeah, I didn't get that he was. Yeah, because he has to go back to work. Theoretically, UNorth is still going to settle.
Yeah, that's going to go ahead. They're going to get a write-off for it.
Yep. He's still going to have to work for 3 years under his confidentiality agreement. So he couldn't talk. He couldn't blow the lid off of the UNorth thing if he wanted to. Yeah, he still doesn't have a restaurant. And he still never got to read the book. So his son will be like even a jerk about that. Hey, even your buddy Arthur read the book.
It's not quite a Chinatown ending, but it's close.
A little bit, yeah. Yeah, and it's not quite a Parallax View ending because it's not as dramatic. He still has to live in this world. This world of corruption and...
with the patina of shit everywhere.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, so Michael Clayton. Very interesting. I'm glad you picked this one, Jason, because this was interesting to watch.
Yeah, it was interesting for me to rewatch. I'm pleased at how well it held up, because it really kind of has it doesn't seem to have aged.
No, except for the cell phones, it's all pretty timeless.
Yeah, because he had a BlackBerry.
Let's take the American out of the equation. Do you think this is George Clooney's best performance?
I don't know that I'm remotely able to answer that question because I haven't seen his performances in the Ocean's movies and I haven't seen a bunch of his other movies and work. So I'd be a little hesitant to say that just because I don't have enough exposure to the other things he's done. It certainly seems though to me that, it seems to me to be very much a good performance from him.
I would agree. This proves that yet again that he's a good actor.
Yeah.
But it also proves that Tom Wilkinson is a treasure.
Oh yeah. Yes. Well, he's great in everything I've seen him in.
I mean, she's amazing. And Sydney Pollack is great too. But again, he's playing Eyed Wide Shut Sydney Pollack.
So the first time you saw Tilda Swinton in the bathroom stall, like sweating it out, did you think she was some like cancer chemo patient?
I think I may have thought that, yeah.
I thought she just murdered somebody.
Yeah, well, that could have easily been, yeah. Yeah. So, Brother Jay, your verdict is it's good. It held up.
I'd give this movie a minus. It still holds up really good, and it captivated me and kept my interest. Boyfriend Jesse did not like it. He fell asleep within 15 minutes. He said it was too slow and didn't have enough action and just didn't interest him. So,
it is a deliberately paced movie.
Yes.
But I thought it was fine, though, because I was intrigued with the characters.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting enough that it moved along pretty nicely.
Yeah. So you would judge it worth it?
Absolutely. Yeah. I want to watch it again.
Yeah, me too.
I want to go watch the baguette scene right now.
Yeah. I want to watch everything that Tom Wilkinson has been in. That will take us a couple years.
As I said, that's a big list.
Yeah. So, okay. So are we on to housekeeping?
Housekeeping.
I only have one thing. Okay. It's relatively short, so I'll jump in. So Kelly has a car that's about a year old now, and it has all the creature comforts that my car doesn't have, including my car doesn't have air conditioning, which right now is an issue because I am at the end of the day, especially on my way home from work, I am... I'm baking myself as I go home. But part of the creature comforts in her car is she has the dual climate zones.
Yes.
Okay. But an ongoing theme in our family is a certain amount of OCD, which, you know, I never consider myself having it, but of course I do. Everybody's on the spectrum at some point. But here's something where Kelly has demonstrated she has a bit of it as well. Her dual zones in her car, she has to have them be the same number. Like, no matter what, she always turns them to the same. Like, if I want one side to be 62 degrees, she will turn her side to 62 as well. Or rather, she will leave hers at 65 and turn mine to 65. Because they have to be the same number, even though there are dual controls. And I asked her, I said, what? And she goes, it's just a thing. Don't worry about it. I'm like, okay.
I suggest some electrical tape.
Yeah, no, it's fine. I'm always a passenger, and I don't really touch much. It's fine. But it's hilarious to see her change the zones, even on my side. Like, okay, well, very, very low stakes, but funny. It amused me.
Yeah, speaking of OCD... our office is going through a remodel, and I forget. Did I ever share my keyboard flip out with you guys?
I don't remember.
I can't remember. I'm not sure.
Okay, this will be two stories. So this is probably a year or so ago, at least now. I was something happened. I dropped something on my keyboard. Like a paperclip or something, and I went to go dig it out between the keys. You know, you don't want to look in between your keys and a keyboard, but I did, and I saw something that looked really conspicuously like a toenail.
This is at home or at work?
No, at work. Okay. So this is a keyboard that had been used by other people before me. and so I saw that, and I lost my shit a little bit, and I decided that this keyboard needed to be cleaned and sanitized right away, to the point where I started popping the keys off. Like, I got a little binder clip, you know, so I could stick it down between the keys, and I just start popping them off, and I totally got tunnel vision. Like, nothing else mattered to me at this point. And like, one of my coworkers ended up walking by my office just in time to see like a key like fly up into her field of vision. So she poked her head into my office.
What's going on?
Yeah, and I was in such a fury of trying to get all this disgusting mess that had been just right under my fingers for probably years that I was now like staring me in the face that I could not tolerate anymore, that I was, I didn't say this, but I was probably pretty close to just like snapping at her, like, don't look at me.
toenails in my keyboard.
Yeah, she's like, is everything okay? And I was like, yes. Move along. I need to finish.
This is here, Jenny. Yeah. Move it along.
Yeah. So, yeah. So, I actually popped all the keys off my keyboard and cleaned it out. Like, found some Clorox wipes. And I'm sure it was horrible for the keyboard. But
keyboards are like $20.
Yeah. I found compressed air. I mean, I cleaned the shit out of that thing. And then, and so I like finally like calmed down and felt some mild embarrassment. But then realized that maybe you guys are better than I am, but you think it's easy.
You know where the keys go back?
Yeah. But do you really know where they go back? 'Cause it turns out I didn't.
that's why you always leave Microsoft Word up when you start cleaning the keyboard.
Yeah, I did not have the Word. I didn't think about anything before I started this job. And so,
and you can't go down to your procurement department and get another keyboard.
Well, no, you can go to your buddy's cube and take a picture of it with your phone.
If you want to explain why you need it. Yeah. So,
or be caught in your buddy's office taking pictures.
Well, yeah. Or you go to your dad's office, who happens to work in the same place.
Yeah, that'd be good too. I'm in my dad's office taking pictures.
So I eventually got everything back together, and it was fine. And you know, dabbed the sweat from my forehead, and probably went home early and.
That drop of sweat went alcohol right onto the keyboard.
Yeah. No, that's fine because it's mine.
Ah, okay.
Anyway, so I guess that's just to kind of set the table. We are undergoing some office improvements. We're getting new carpet. All our offices are being painted. To accommodate that, when it's your turn, you're actually going to get moved out of your office and displaced for a day, and then you move back in, which means when it's getting close, we all have to pack up our entire office. And you know, our support folks have made this very easy on us. You know, they give us boxes with labels, and that's really all we have to do is just throw our shit into boxes, and then they'll take care of it.
Dad's boxes are marked tick figurines number one, tick figurines number two, tick figurines number four.
He has a lot of crap in his office.
I can imagine.
So, I mean, so that's all well and good. And my office move was supposed to be this Tuesday coming up. It's been moved like to almost, I think, probably August. So, but. I thought I was going to have to be prepared to move next week. So I was packing all my stuff up into boxes. And I realized once you start moving stuff around, my office was so dirty and dusty that I was having a mild version of that same keyboard freak out. I was like, I can't work in here. I can't live like this. Who lives like this? Why is it like this? And I'm not a neat freak. Like, my office is kind of a disaster. Like, my organization system is piles, but just like the dirt and the grime that I was not aware of was like really freaking me out. And then I'm like looking at everything. I'm like looking at my phone, like, oh, why is my earpiece so disgusting? Like, putting it back. And yeah. So, that's what I spent the last like hour today doing, is just like scrubbing my office so that I could actually walk into it on Monday without having a panic attack.
I don't have any housekeeping this week.
Except for the fact your computer died.
Well,
laptop melted down last night.
I still don't know what's wrong with it. I've restored it from a backup and it's seemingly stable, but every time I think it's stable, I go and do something with it and it just says nope. So I don't know.
Is it relatively old? It's not super old, right?
It's 5 years old.
Okay, well.
It's 5 years old, and as I was explaining to boyfriend Jesse, it doesn't get light use. It's had a bit of heavy use, especially because, you know, what we're doing right now with the video conferencing and recording audio and editing and all this other stuff I'm doing with it, it's pretty hard on it. It's a pretty rough life. CPU-wise, it's energy intensive, it's heat intensive. And then in the past, I've used it for things like serving music over the house server and serving media through my Apple TV. And, it burned a bunch of slideshows for Graminori. And so it's been utilized to its capacity. Probably to its detriment. And I only recently got an air cooler for it to keep it kind of cool-ish. I probably should have approached that some time ago. So we'll see how this one seems. I mean, it's clearly faster. So this is good.
Pack the bikes, load the car, and roll the windows down. The Andersons from Anchorage are getting out of town. We're going camping. It's summertime. Trail River, Willow Walk, Horse Creek, and Porcupine. Doesn't matter where we go, with our pod we'll be fine. Staring out the window at the mountains and the trees. On the road, singing songs and making memories. Yeah, we're going. Start a fire to keep us warm. Sticks can also break to make families by the shore. Salmon swimming up the stream. Festivals with blueberries. Yeah, we're going camping. We won't forget the time we spent together, Lizzie, Emma, Mom, and Dad. When the snow comes falling down, remember June will come around. No. And we'll go camping next summertime. Yeah. Until next time.
Not in a creepy way. 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 Okay. Not in a creepy way. Not in a creepy way. Got Eric.